Hello, I'm Audrey Brown, and today in Focus on Africa, as the war in the Middle East continues, we're hearing about African domestic workers trapped in Lebanon without papers or the means to escape.
The very day in September the 26th, close to me, the bomb exploded. We decided to leave the area, to stay in the beach for 1 week, to sleep outside to save my life.
In front of our house, if the bomb there. They leave me and run away because these people, they do not care about me and just take their things and go.
And we'll be visiting a town in the American South, known for welcoming asylum seekers from around the world, to find out what African migrants there expect from President-elect Donald Trump.
Now, Trump is our president and he have to make the quality life of the low-income people, especially the housing that we have problem. As immigrants, the paycheck is not increasing and the cost of living, the rent, the insurance, everything is going up. People are struggling economically.
It's Friday, the 8th of November. First, we go to Mauritius. A country known for its sunshine, food and tourism. It is also known as one of Africa's strongest democracies, a beacon of best practice, according to just about any index by which these things are measured. That's what Mauritius looks like from the outside. The people inside the country say this reputation is not deserved. Recently, there's been a wiretapping scandal involving leaked conversations between high-ranking members of the political elite. The government announced a block on all social media platforms in response. It was intended to last until the day after the election, but public outcry led to the ban being dropped. The opposition said the government did it to avoid losing elections, which are due on Sunday. The ruling Militant Socialist Movement, or MSM, is hoping to retain its majority in the People's Alliance Coalition, which will give Prime Minister Pravin Kumar Jagnauth another 5 years in office. Rukaya Kasanali is a democracy scholar in Mauritius. We began a conversation with her explaining why Mauritians are not convinced that their country is doing that well in the democracy stakes.
It used to be the case. I mean, Mauritius, as you rightly said, used to be the beacon of democracy on the African continent. But it's no more the case. And I think evidence points to that in terms of, the latest indicators, whether it's the Mo Ibrahim Index for good governance, whether it's the varieties in democracy, whether it's the latest round of Afrobarometer or the Global International Idea Global Democracy Index. Mauritius has really, really backslided in the last 10 years. And that backsliding has accelerated in the last 5 years. So you will see the whole issue around satisfaction towards democracy has plummeted by 40%. People are dissatisfied in the type of democracy we have. There has been a free fall in digital freedom. So we are now 25th out of 54 countries in Africa. It's a minus 22% in the last 10 years. Political and civil liberties have been reined in. So the list goes on and on. And usually when I speak about Mauritius, I say that unfortunately we have been a victim of our success because we have always been classified. And over time, we started to slip. And this decline slip has actually, been very much, we didn't realize that what was happening.
Why has Mauritius slipped in all these indices? And it does seem rather to have crept up on the rest of the world as well, because I can tell you quite freely that I'm surprised to hear this.
I know. A lot of friends and people I talk to who say, and they are surprised that, very often Mauritius doesn't make the headline for autocratizing or democratic decline. I think there's a couple of reasons. One is the weakening of institutions, because institutions are usually the guardrails of a democratic culture and system. So, for example, we've seen in the last 10 years and 5 years, more specifically, Parliament has been completely captured. We know that that Mauritius operated along what we call separation of power between the legislature, the executive, and the judiciary. So in the last parliamentary life session, we saw that the House Speaker was extremely partial towards the ruling party. Every single time we saw members of parliament being, you know, named, called, or suspended. And the second element was that basically we've seen another institution that is key to checks and balances is the police. It has been weaponized, it has been captured. Parts of the judiciary have been under strain. And there's been a very interesting example in the recent year and a half where the Director of Public Prosecution, which is a constitutionally guarded position, there has been an attempt to rein it in under the executive. So you can see there's been a number of chipping away and weakening of key institutions that have actually weakened the whole process of checks and balances. The second element is that we've seen over time the introduction of certain types of projects that for me has started to sort of tracked, monitored, controlled, and created what I call a surveillance state. So the example of the Safe City project, which is the Mauritius Safe City project that was inaugurated in 2019. These are cameras, some 4,000 cameras and 24/7 with facial recognition that is basically attempting to sort of monitor and control people's movements. And the other element has been use of biometric data. So I think it's all happening within an understanding that data is being used to sort of have a little bit of a big brother approach on people's movement and associations.
Seems to me that brings us very neatly to the wiretapping scandal.
Exactly.
And leaked conversations between politicians, police, lawyers, journalists, and civil society members that is actually circulating on social media. So you're saying that that is part of a broader attempt to control and monitor people. Tell us a little bit about these wiretaps. What are the conversations and who's accused of doing it and who's been caught in the trap?
Well, basically, these are alleged conversations through wiretapping, but it also links to another event, another episode that made headlines around a sniffing scandal in 2021-2022, where the CEO of one of the key telecommunication companies, Mauritius Telecom, actually resigned. And he mentioned that, you know, there was interference from a foreign third party onto one of the very important underwater cables that connects Mauritius to Africa. And then this wiretapping came and it invited itself to the election campaign in terms of slowly starting to sort of provide citizens with a number of content which talked about opposition being tapped. And then it started to look at some more matters of greater concern around the Commission of Police in terms of police brutality, murder cover-up. And then it went into the Prime Minister's private conversation, alleged. Everything is deemed alleged because no one knows the authenticity of those wiretapping. But initially, the Prime Minister mentioned that this was doctored by artificial intelligence and he gave no credit to that. Then he backtracked and he said, it might be my voice, but it's not what I've been talking about. So it really created a bit of a great confusion, but things have accelerated. But it really sorts of, you know, sheds light on elements of who's tapping whom. And the conversation has well been that wiretap always happened in parts of the world and Mauritius is not different.
So these leaks contained in the wiretaps, contested as they are, one could say, I suppose, that they were designed to influence the outcome of the election. Do you think it will?
Mauritians do not like speaking openly about their intentions of vote, who are they going to vote and their intention of voting. So I don't know to what extent the impact will be, but the conversations I have with people say that they are shocked and their mind is blown out in terms of the level of interference and the type of content that is being circulated. What I know is that following the social ban that came into operation on the 1st of November, a lot lot of people were angry in terms of why did this ban happen, when the traction around those leaks were gaining dizzying heights in terms of followings.
So you're referring to the ban on social media, the blocking of it.
Mm-hmm.
I suppose in that particular regard, Mauritius doesn't seem to be too different to other African countries, because we see more and more, and especially around elections or times of heightened feelings and tensions in the country, that the government turns to social media banning. So what do you think the ban was all about? Was it to control discussion?
Well, the official response from the government was it's about national security, because the conversations of the prime minister was on his fix and secure line. So the national security narrative came and kicked in terms of that we had to ban social media because it was an issue of national security. But there was such a backlash. I mean, the backlash was linked to the fact that, you know, both locals, average citizens, but also supported by regional stakeholders and different sort of support groups, created such a storm that the social media ban was reversed just 24 hours after. So answering your question, was it about social control? I think yes.
Let's talk about the election, the build up to the elections. What are the main issues, and especially with regard to the issues that would concern young people? What do they care about? What do they want from their next set of leaders?
I think one of the biggest issues that every single Mauritian is concerned today, whether it's a, you know, young or middle-aged or elderly, is the very, very high cost of living. In the last 10 years, our local currency, which is the Mauritian rupee, has been devalued to 40%. And that has caused massive high inflation in the country. And that has, you know, had an effect on public debt. So when we're talking about what are the concerns of citizens, and more specifically Mauritians, is, you know, getting a job, ensuring that, you know, that there is meritocracy in the country, that there is a level playing field in terms of equality. Because again, referring to the latest scorecard of the Mo Ibrahim Index, one of the most sort of concerning indicator has been that, you know, protection against discrimination has gone down by 44.5%. So people feel very discriminated, and we see that the young people have a feeling that this culture of meritocracy doesn't really operate. One element that also is of great concern to the youth is the spread of drugs. Mauritius, unfortunately, in the last 10 years has become, you know, a playground for synthetic drugs.
Is that linked to the tourism industry? Because that's one of the strongest industries in Mauritius, right?
Well, the spread of drugs is because of the fact that Mauritius is an island, and it has, you know, the fact that it's very porous in terms of its borders. And that has been something that has happened over time. But more recently, it has accelerated. And here I'm not talking about hard drugs. I'm talking about the presence of synthetic drugs.
Will there be a turn up for the books, you think? Who do you think is going to win?
I wouldn't want to say anything about that. I always believe that the unpredictability of elections are what makes elections. But I think it's interesting to factor in a couple of issues. The current outgoing government has been in power for 10 years. Is there a fatigue towards them? They have had a number of scandals that have followed them. The leaks that have happened since now a good 10, 14 days, whether that's going to play against them. The democratic backsliding of Mauritius during this particular government's mandate of 10 years, whether that's going to play against them, I'm not sure. I think we'll only know that on the next day of poll, which is the 11th of November.
Thank you very much. It's really fascinating talking to you about this.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you, Rukaya. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
That was Rukaya Kasinali, a democracy scholar in Mauritius. That is the sound of airstrikes which millions of people in Lebanon have to live through since Israeli attacks began in September. The inevitable death followed, as well as displacement of tens of thousands of people. Everyone is fleeing. Everyone is frightened. But there is a particularly vulnerable group in Lebanon, and we've spoken about them and to them before. African women working as domestic laborers. Many of them have been left stranded by their employers, who either died or fled. The women are unable to leave because they don't have their papers with them. Under the system of employment, the kafala system, the employers have total control over these women. Countries like Ethiopia and Kenya have been able to get their citizens out, but thousands of others are still stuck there. Local charities are helping with food and shelter. The BBC's Emir Nader visited one of these shelters in Beirut. He's been hearing the harrowing experiences of Zainab Bangura and Aisha Koroma.
The very day in September the 26th, close to me, the bomb exploded. We decided to leave the area, to stay in the beach for 1 week, to sleep outside to save my life.
In front of our house, if the bomb there. They leave me and run away because these people, they do not care about me and just take their things and go.
We've just heard from two women talking about their experiences when the bombing started, and it seems like they feel abandoned. So what are the living conditions that these women and children are living in the shelter that they are in now?
So both of those women are from Sierra Leone. They're domestic migrant workers and have been abandoned by their families when the bombing escalated in Lebanon, when Israel sort of expanded its airstrike campaign there. And it left thousands of domestic migrant workers without a place to live. They were working for families, and then all of a sudden they found themselves homeless. So many were sleeping outdoors on the beach in Beirut. Many set up tents. There were people in the main squares there. And so it led to a lot of charities stepping in to set up impromptu shelters or other more established charities working to try and provide some shelter for those domestic workers. That shelter there is around 250 women, all from Sierra Leone. It's way better than being outside, but it's an industrial hangar, one huge great room, quite Spartan, concrete walls, but there is a kitchen, there's a place to do your washing, you know, food is provided. There's no privacy. It's one room with mattresses on the floor, possessions, kids running around. But the mood wasn't too bad given the circumstances. And I think, you know, it's probably quite comforting for women who are in a strange country, displaced, to be around, you know, people from their own country as well. One thing they were really grateful for is having Wi-Fi there that the charity was able to provide. And it just had a feeling of, you know, now we have to wait to see what's next.
And yet women like those, and especially some women, it seems like from Sierra Leone, often find themselves at the mercy of charity because the families that they work for literally abandon them when there's any sign of trouble. And Liberia has had lots of shocks in recent years. I'm thinking back, for instance, to the bombing. You know, so many women found themselves out on the street, or when the economy tanks and women don't get paid. And also the system on which they come into the country, the kafala system, it ultimately makes them more vulnerable to abuse. I'm just wondering, is there any sign of that system being reformed in order to make sure that people like the women that we've been hearing from and the hundreds and thousands of women who come from different parts of the continent to work in Lebanon are not left in this position?
Even before the war, this kafala system, as they call it, has been really widely criticised because, as your listeners might know, a family will sponsor the residency of a domestic migrant worker. And often when that woman is working in a house, they have their passport taken off them by the family, and they often don't leave the home. The kafala system has been called by some human rights groups, in the worst cases, it's akin to modern slavery because women often don't get paid. You're really at the mercy of the family. I think now in the situation of war, it's very low down the list of priorities of groups to try and make a legal change because the country is barely able to cope. You know, there's over 1 million Lebanese people displaced, as well as the UN estimates around 17,000 migrant workers have been displaced. So the country is already struggling to adapt with all this displacement, providing for the needs of people in an emergency and a crisis. So it isn't at the top of the priority right now.
It does seem like they never prioritize anyway, because we've been reporting about how badly people get treated. You spoke about charities that step in at times of crisis for people. And yes, we appreciate that Lebanon is going through a difficult time. And whenever there's a difficult time, the domestic workers are the ones that are at the bottom of the list. They are the ones that are most vulnerable because they're far away from home and they often don't have documentation. So Are there organizations or countries that are stepping in to help, especially in terms of securing safe return for workers to their home countries? And then just accountability for the way they get treated.
There are some countries that are helping repatriate the migrant workers who are there. So whilst we were there, we heard of a flight organized by the Ethiopian government to return about 200 people who were wanting to go back. In that shelter alone, around three quarters of the women want to go back to Sierra Leone, but many of them don't have their passports. So they've been working with the Sierra Leone consulate to try and get new papers in order to go back. You know, many women also wanted to stay because they don't have the money to go back. The UN, its international migration wing of the UN, have said that they've had thousands of requests, about 3,000, to help repatriate domestic workers to go back home. So it's an issue that needs work on. However, the Lebanese government's doing very little, and the companies involved in bringing the migrant workers to Lebanon, they're very defensive. We met one man who's the representative of the network of companies that brings these women over. We put our questions to him about, you know, should the companies that he represents be doing more to support these women who've been abandoned?
I can tell you the disaster that came from Israel is not only on the domestic helpers. Some families, they abandoned their brothers and sisters and mothers. The shock that came to the Lebanese people, in a 2 minutes time, leave your house with nothing. You know, some of the houses they have left without their own documents. The gold of the money, they just run away.
So that was Joseph Saliba, who is one of the representatives of, you know, the network of companies that brings these women over. And very defensive. It's, you know, Israel is causing this displacement crisis through its airstrike campaign. The government has no money. You know, people aren't even able to look after their own Lebanese people in this moment of crisis. So, you know, that's why the domestic workers, you know, are left alone. But as you mentioned before, these are vulnerable women in a strange country. They don't have that support network. Unlike Lebanese people who might stay with relatives or charities, the government has set up about 900 shelters for displaced people. But we've heard of domestic workers who have been made homeless going to them and being turned away because they're not Lebanese. So it just shows you how vulnerable you can be in a situation like this.
Is there any sign that this will change soon? Because Lebanon has been subject to a lot of shocks, and women, thousands of them who come from other countries, they really are vulnerable and they find themselves out on the streets at the drop of a hat. Are they able to return home now? Are there plans for them to be able to return home? Because if you've lost your documentation, for instance, are there problems that they're facing with getting their documentation to go home? Are they willing to go home? Do they want to go home, or are they prepared to wait it out?
I think it depends who you speak to. I think a lot of the women who've been there for a longer period of time feel a bit traumatized by the experience of not only the way they've been treated by their families, but, you know, a lot of these women, including the women we heard from at the top, have, you know, had experienced the conflict very close to them. So many do want to leave, especially the ones who've been there a longer period of time, and they're trying to get their documents from overwhelmed consulates who have many people demanding support all at once. In the shelter that we went to, a quarter of the women there want to stay, partly because one of the workers who's organised the shelter says they've only been there a couple of years. They haven't yet made much money to send back. They need to make money in order to afford the ticket home as well. So you're really trapped in a tricky situation. So there is a desire to go home amongst some of the women, but for others, they want to try and ride it out and try to see if they can find work with a new family. We also spoke to one woman that you heard at the top, who is called Zainab, who had an accident in the home that she was working in. She slipped over in some water and really damaged her side and her spine, and she was walking with a limp. She said, "I want to go home. I want to go back to Sierra Leone, but I know the treatment that I might be able to get here, if I'm supported, if there's a charity that can support me, would be much better than what I could receive back in Sierra Leone as well." So, you know, there's many different complications and factors that play into whether someone is able to go get back home, and indeed if they feel able to go back home.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Audrey.
The BBC's Emir Nader, just back from Beirut. This is Focus on Africa from the BBC World Service.
This will truly be the golden age of America. That's what we have to have.
With Donald Trump's recent election victory, a group of people in the town of Clarkson, just outside of Atlanta in the South, are watching closely to hear how a new administration might treat them. They are paying careful attention because they are immigrants and asylum seekers. They come from all over the world, many from Somalia, Eritrea, Ethiopia, and Sudan. Clarkson has long welcomed people from everywhere. But migration was a big issue in the elections, and Atlanta has particularities that make it stand out. It is a mecca for black culture and business. It has a long and proud tradition in the fight for civil rights in the United States. It is also quite conservative, socially and politically. My colleague Rhoda Odhiambo was in Clarkson for much of this week, including Election Day on Tuesday. We began our conversation with a snapshot of Clarkson.
So Clarkson is an area in Atlanta that has a lot of African migrants and also migrants from other parts of the world who are living there. Other than the migrants who migrated to the U.S. legally, who live there are also those who've lived there and moved into the U.S. illegally. There are also those from Afghanistan, from Pakistan, who are also asylum seekers. Well, the whole of Clarkston and Decatur is known as a Democratic stronghold in the entire Georgia, one of the areas that Democrats would get a lot of votes. But in this particular election, most of the people who would vote Democrat decided to either vote for the Green Party candidate or voted Republican, basically because of what is happening in the Middle East, the war in Gaza, and also the war in Sudan, especially looking at America's stance on those two areas where the conflict is ongoing. So a lot of the people I spoke to said that they would not vote for the Democratic Party because of what is happening. And if they voted for the Republican Party, it's more or less giving away their vote.
Are asylum seekers allowed to vote in the U.S.?
They're not allowed to vote, but those who are eligible to vote and live in Clarkston City, these are people who had already been in the country for 5 years. They already got their necessary documents like the passport, and they were able to vote in this particular election. For those who are not able to vote now, they would rally their partners to go out and vote for them, because whatever decision they made on the ballot box would influence how long they would be able to stay in the country and what benefits they would be able to get inside the country.
So Donald Trump is the president-elect. What was their reaction when they found out that he had won?
Mixed reactions. So a lot of people were happy that Harris did not win because number one was the gender card that was being played. A lot of people I spoke to were of the opinion that the household name in a particular house, that it will always be the man who is in charge of the house. So a lot of them did not feel that Kamala Harris would have the right support that she needed to be able to lead the United States of America. But also looking broadly at her policies, and she was not convincing enough to be able to persuade voters on how to vote for her. Those who did not vote Democrat say that as much as she's held like so many rallies talking about what she would be able to implement, she did not really give a clear response on what she would do when she's elected into office. For those who voted Republican, most of them said that at least Trump was clear about what he was going to do. I know one of them told me that it's better the enemy you know than the friend you do not know, because Trump was clear by saying, if I'm elected into office, this is what I'm going to do. These are the policies I'm going to implement, whether people like it or not. But what he wanted to do was to make America great again. So a lot of people had varied opinions. And for those who were undecided, they said that so long as we're able to live here, so long as the incoming president is able to improve the economy, then they might as well just carry on with the president-elect, hoping that he would be able to address some of the concerns that they have.
Were you surprised? Because I'm surprised, actually, because Donald Trump, one of the main planks of his campaigning had been that, you know, making life as uncomfortable as possible for asylum seekers, for people who come from, you know, south of the border, as it were, in other parts of the world. And there's a very faint distinction between legal and illegal. But also, he had also said that on day one, you know, people whom they don't believe belong in the U.S. will be deported. So mass deportations for the people that you were talking to or people like them.
So personally, I wasn't surprised that Donald Trump was going to win this particular election. I had a feeling even before coming to the U.S. to cover this election that he is going to win this particular election, just on the grounds that he was saying what people wanted to hear. And when I talk about people, I'm talking about Americans living in the United States, what they wanted to hear. The key issue, of course, being the economy, migration and illegal immigration are some of like the key issues. If we look at illegal immigration, those people who would come in through like the Mexican border, for instance, yes, we do also have like Africans who've been reported to come in. But a lot of African migrants who I have spoken to and have said that they also have a problem with people who are migrating to the US illegally is when they still come here, that the taxes they pay still have to end up taking care of them. And as much as they don't have a problem with that because people are coming into the US for a better future, those I spoke to still have families, someone to bring over their wives, someone have to bring over their children. But the visa process takes such a long time. Some have to wait for an interview for as much as like 4 years or 3 years. So that whole process, they're saying that it's not fair to them. If they're going to deal with illegal migration, they should also deal with legal migration, such that those who are waiting to bring over their spouse legally through the documented processes that are available, they should be able to have the same benefits. Also for those who have benefited from the DACA program, who are able to live in the US legally, but they're not able to have a US passport, where some of them are married to Americans, but they're not American citizens. So that's also something that's been very key among these people as to why they are more or less undecided or okay with the option that a lot of Americans voted. On the issue of abortion, it's also something that has come out a lot. A lot of people are saying that, yes, as much as this is a thorny issue and it's something that the Democratic Party used to be able to sway women to come out and vote for them, to come up with better policies that are not governed by federal or state government. But a lot of people are saying that, look, you can't talk about abortion if you don't talk about the other aspects of family planning. Abortion should not only be elective, it should something that it needs to be medically necessary. And that is why even Trump, when he was campaigning, all he kept saying is that he's not going to enforce a ban, but it's being brought back to the state level where states would still be the ones to make the decisions. And here are some of the people that I spoke to earlier.
I vote with Donald Trump because of we need to come back our business. Economy is all the way down. I'm an electrician in 6 years in U.S. Nobody fixes his homes. Nobody fixes electric. Because of economic. So now we say, when Donald Trump get it, now we say, let us hit the road. Economy come back.
When there's competition, when somebody wins, you have to congratulate for him, the person who win. And now Trump is our president, and we are planning that he have to make the quality life of the low-income people, especially the housing, that we have problem as immigrants and as the low-income people. The paycheck is not increasing, and the cost of living, the rent, the insurance, everything is going up.
Those are some voices there in Clarkston, where Rhoda has been spending the last few days. So why is Clarkston such a magnet for people from different parts of the world, legal and illegal?
So a lot of the people who lived here in the past moved to other areas because of the development aspect, and Clarkston became sort of dry in the sense of a lot of people were not living there. Those, again, born in Atlanta, whether white or mixed race or black. So when the city, particular area, needed people to move in to be able to revive it, a lot of the people who ended up living there and moving there and relocating there due to the number of organizations that support people who are seeking asylum or refugees, a lot of refugees now ended up living there, and also migrants from different parts. And it's also an area where people feel like safe and they are comfortable, like they're living in their own country. For instance, when I walked through various neighborhoods in Clarkston, it felt like I was pretty much walking in Somalia, for instance, in Mogadishu, because there are a lot of Somali restaurants, there are a lot of plazas being owned by Somalis, and also an area that also had like a lot of Nigerian restaurants. So it did feel like you are walking in Lagos. You did feel like you were home. But the only difference is the systems that were in place.
They call Clarkston the Ellis Island of the South, in the sense that it's unique for welcoming asylum seekers and immigrants from across the world. I'm just wondering whether a Trump administration will change the character of a place like that, because we know in other parts of the U.S. where you have concentrations of migrants, for instance, like Haitians, whether they're legal or not, as soon as people start talking about Haitians eating their dogs or eating their pets, their reactions against those communities. Did you find that in Clarkston? Do you think that that might happen in Clarkston?
Yes, there is. There is that fear that people have that with Trump coming into power and the plans that he has for mass deportation could play a big part that. But a lot of people, like I remember one person who voted saying that, I know immigration is a big issue, especially for someone like me. People don't like someone who looks like me. And I could see the pain in his eyes because he migrated to the US 10 years ago. But they were still able to say that as much as immigration is still an issue for people who identify not as Americans who were born there, but they still feel that because they already have the legal papers to live there and work, they can justify why they're there and why they deserve equal rights in everything that America can be able to offer. They still want to be able to make a living. Most of them are businessmen. They are truck drivers. They run plazas and people pay rent to them. So they're still saying that as much as, yes, they have this fear of what could happen, but the greater good of looking ahead is they're saying that at least the economy would be able to thrive and they would be able to have good business returns when they start working and when Trump takes over next year.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you. Bye.
That's Rhoda Odhiambo in Clarkston, Atlanta, in the American South. Focus on Africa was compiled by Nyasha Michelle, Bella Hassan and Joseph Keane here in London. Blessing Aderogba did her bit from Lagos. Carney Sharp was the senior journalist in charge. Craig Kingham was our technical producer. Andre Lombard and Alice Mudenge are our editors. Before I go, a quick reminder that you should listen to our sister podcast, Africa Daily. It's good value. It really is. A deep dive into one topical story from the continent or about the continent and its people a day. I'm Audrey Brown. We'll talk again next time.